KCSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Today I'm excited to have on a co-affiliate scholar at CIS, Marvin Amori. And Marvin has authored an article just recently published in a Wisconsin Law Review called First Amendment Architecture. And our focus today is going to be on the First Amendment, but more specifically on the spaces available for people to speak. We have discussed the First Amendment in a variety of settings on Hearsay Culture. Today's discussion perhaps will be the most directly focused on the Constitution and on theory underlying the First Amendment. We've discussed the First Amendment primarily in the context of its relationship to the fair use defense to copyright infringement, something that is near and dear to the hearts of many listeners of Hearsay Culture and certainly well-known to people that focus on intellectual property. The First Amendment, however, is not synonymous with the fair use defense, and therefore it's appropriate to have conversations about the First Amendment, specifically and particularly how the First Amendment relates to our core functions in technology as well as in other places involving speech. And so in Marvin's article, Marvin takes a close look not only at the theories underlying the First Amendment, but what he calls speech spaces, places literally where people have the opportunity to speak. And we think about speech spaces, and I'll ask Marvin to define it in more detail in our discussion. We think of speech spaces traditionally, you know, as the classic person standing on a box in a town square. We think of speech spaces as newspapers, both print and otherwise. But today, of course, we have a variety of places where people can engage in speech. And interestingly, the Constitution and the law and the theory underlying the First Amendment perhaps changes the way we think about what speech can occur in those places and when speech can be controlled. The Internet, of course, being the focus of Hearsay Culture, is a particular challenge to regulators, to jurists, to people in legislatures, to judges, and to people who are speaking, because it creates enormous conflicts in the law with regard to what the standard should be for actual speech. When should we say that this speech is okay in a given venue? When should we challenge it? And indeed, when should those spaces and exist and what parameters should exist there? And so, of course, our focus on Hearsay Culture is technology, and so we will be spending a good amount of time on the Internet. But in Marvin's article, which is, as any good law review article is, extensively footnoted, he discusses a variety of theories underlying the First Amendment. We're going to spend some time on that as well. So First Amendment Architecture is an article that has gotten some attention already. It's been the subject of discussions on a variety of blogs, and it's an article that I had come across in my own research, and I'm excited to have Marvin on today. Marvin, for those that aren't familiar, is a well-recognized thinker in internet law and public policy. He's worked on a variety of public policy issues, including perhaps most notably network neutrality, but also was active in the efforts to oppose SOPA and PIPA. He is a 2013 Bernard L. Schwartz Fellow at the New American Foundation, which is a think tank in Washington. He is also an affiliate scholar, as I mentioned, at Stanford Law School Center for Internet Society. He's a term member at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he's represented a number of companies in the technology sector involving a variety of areas, including having been a technology advisor to the 2008 Obama campaign and transition. He is a lawyer in practice, as well as a scholar, as well as a speaker on a variety of topics, and he is joining us today via Skype on May 30th for airing next week from his home in Washington, D.C. Marvin, thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you for having me, David. It's a great pleasure.
Let's start off, Marvin, with a question I ask most of my authors, and I'll tailor, of course, to your work. Tell us a bit more about your background and how you became interested in the First Amendment, broadly speaking.
So I got interested in the First Amendment way back in law school. Now, I remember taking constitutional law and learning about, you know, the importance of freedom of speech for democracy and for individual liberty, and learning about the important role of judges in striking down laws adopted by Congress that infringed on our freedom of speech. It's a place where majority rule doesn't reign supreme because courts will strike down laws that infringe on the minority's right to speak. And I remember in constitutional law class reading all these cases about street corner speakers, about hate speech, about pamphleteers. And the professor said, you know, we're not going to cover broadcast speech or speech on cable or the internet much. That's too complicated, and it's special, and it's different. And I remember, you know, sort of taking it at face value and then taking communications law class from Yochai Benkler, actually. And at some point, he said, why don't First Amendment scholars and constitutional lawyers talk about cable more and broadcast more? Why do they think of these media, including the internet, why do they think of them as exceptions to free speech when we use them every day to communicate with one another, when they're the place where we get much of our news, much of our culture, right? Why do we focus on pamphlets when we talk about the First Amendment? And so my interest in this began with a paper that I wrote in law school, sort of looking at the ways that constitutional casebooks used in law school focus on street corner speech, focus on pamphlets, on flag burning. And then I asked the question, what would happen if we thought about the First Amendment based on the cases and decisions that govern the internet, that govern cable, and that govern TV? And my conclusion was that you would think of the First Amendment totally differently. You'd have a sort of different idea of what underlies our commitment to free speech. And that looking at, you know, the way free speech actually happens in society would lead to better thinking in, you know, in the FCC, in the Supreme Court, and at all levels. And so really for the past 10 years, I've been working on that question, in part, among other things, of what should and does the First Amendment mean when we think about it in terms of electronic media and the way people actually communicate with one another today.
And that gets us into, I think, the word architecture, which I want to discuss in a moment. But before we get there, as I mentioned in the introduction, and like I said, many listeners are familiar with this, you're involved in advocacy on a variety of issues. And I should have mentioned that Fast Company magazine recently named you as one of the 100 most creative people in business for 2012, particularly because of your efforts against Stop Online Piracy Act and Protect IP, SOAP, and PIPA. I'm curious, with regard to your advocacy, how your advocacy work impacts the work that you're doing now on the First Amendment. What is the relationship, as it were?
So I think that there's a two-way relationship. What I learn in my scholarship and in my research and my thinking about the First Amendment helps me think about what kinds of rules I think we as a society should have for the internet. So when a new law is proposed, like SOPA or PIPA, or, you know, net neutrality rules, thinking about it for me in the context of what kind of free speech environment do we want, right? What can we learn from the decisions made throughout our history regarding free speech? What can democratic principles, how can they guide us when we choose new laws? Right? So that's how my scholarship influences my advocacy. For many years, I was the head lawyer and then a senior advisor to a consumer advocacy group called Free Press that worked on net neutrality and led the Save the Internet Coalition. And now I do a lot of, I think, pro-free speech work while I advise companies. And so there's that one way from scholarship to advocacy. But also my advocacy helps me see the flaws and problems, in my opinion, in existing free speech scholarship and existing free speech theory. To give one example, and this is an example that I mentioned in the article, you know, if your model for free speech as a scholar is flag burning, right, if that's your image, then in your mind, right, there's a private speaker who's trying to dissent from the government. There's the government passing a law banning flag burning to try to silence a speaker. And then the speaker challenges the law in court, and the judge is the hero that strikes down the congressional law that would have burdened free speech. That's sort of your image. Your image is government should stay out of speech, government's untrustworthy and simply trying to suppress dissenters, and the judge is the hero. But when you look at laws such as proposed laws like SOPA and PIPA, copyright legislation that would have affected how speech happens on the internet, when you look at the FCC's rules for net neutrality, you have a totally different picture of what's going on. Instead of the judge being the central actor and you know, Congress suppressing dissent, you have a democratic debate amongst the public about how we should structure free speech media, how we should structure access to spaces where we communicate to one another, right? We have the legislature and agencies working with technologists and business people and whoever and consumer advocacy groups and the public to ask the question of how should we structure speech in our democratic society. And that's totally different from the flag burning question. And then you have lots of hard questions of, who should have power to speak to whom, and how technical rules about the internet will affect, our speech environment, whether it'll be more decentralized, less decentralized, whether, you know, we'll have an environment of lots of bloggers or lots of big studios that dominate speech. And so that's essentially how my advocacy has affected my scholarship. There are lots of problems in scholarship that I tend to see on the ground because to me some of the most important free speech questions aren't being addressed by judges who are generalists and have no expertise in technology, but by democratic institutions, by individuals, by technologists, and sort of a democratic debate about what our free speech environment should look like. And that throughout our history, we've had such debates over the postal system, the telegraph, the telephone system, broadcasting cable. We haven't always made the right decision, but some of our most important decisions have been totally far away from judges and in the hands of really everyday people who can affect, to the extent they can, Congress. And I think that's sort of empowering, that the average person has a say in what the First Amendment means and how we will use the First Amendment to guide our legislation and shape our society.
We're chatting with Marvin Amori on Hearsay Culture in KZSU. Marvin, you know, in light of what you just said and in light of your background, I feel compelled to ask this question. I'm not asking you to name names, but there's a lot of criticism that Congress in particular, but also the president has received over the last year plus with regard to SOPA and PIPA, but more broadly with the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement and trans-Pacific partnership and a variety of international lawmaking. And among the criticisms, and one in particular I want to focus on, is a criticism that basically says that legislatures don't get it. They don't understand technology. They don't understand the impact of these rules. And therefore, there's a need for more input, but also putting aside issues of capture and campaign finance for a moment, there's simply a lack of understanding of the technology. Given your experience in working not just on SOPA and PIPA, but over several years on a variety of topics, including net neutrality, what's your reaction to that criticism?
It's a very valid criticism that Congress and even our agencies don't have enough technical expertise. However, we do live in a world of imperfect institutions, and somebody has to make decisions. It's simply impossible not to decide. We can't avoid a decision on net neutrality. We can't avoid a decision on copyright. We can't avoid a political decision on the future of the internet, internationally. And so when we look at the institutions out there, right, we don't put our faith only in one. But, you know, let's just compare. We have to do sort of comparative institutional analysis, as a scholar would say. Or we simply ask, you know, which institution is least bad? So judges, right? Judges are generalists. They're appointed for life. They have a few generalist legal clerks. They have very little technical capacity. They might rely on, you know, expert witnesses and expert briefs. But they don't really have a lot of technical expertise compared to the kind of expertise you would have in the FCC or perhaps even in Congress. And it's also allowed, so you not only have technical expertise, you have the question of democratic input and legitimacy. And there are some avenues for influencing a court for the public, such as amici briefs from consumer groups and activism groups. But they're also, they're designed, the court, the federal courts at least, are designed to be more insulated from public opinion than, say, the House of Representatives, where every 2 years there's an election, and they're supposed to be tethered to the constituents they represent. So both in terms of democratic input and expertise, there are some benefits in working with Congress. There is definitely the huge problem of campaign finance, although if you want to blame anyone for the corruption in Congress, what Larry Lessig calls corruption in Congress, dependence corruption, if you want to blame anyone, you should blame this Supreme Court, ironically enough, which has struck down campaign finance regulation passed by Congress. And so when you look at these institutions, you don't bet on anyone. And as an advocate, you know, I will make my arguments to Congress, to the FCC, to the judiciary, and I always encourage the public that has a stake in these debates to do the same. So that's sort of my take on it, is that, you know, all of these institutions are imperfect, all of them have problems, but we're stuck with problematic institutions. We should try to improve them, but as advocates and citizens, we have to make do with what we have.
When we think about and turning towards your article, because we could spend the rest of the interview on campaign finance, but I want to focus on your piece. You initially talked about a little bit, but I just want to be clear. What is architecture in the context of the First Amendment? What does that word mean?
So I use architecture as the idea that we structure our speech environment in terms of the spaces that are available to average citizens to speak. So I begin the paper with a hypothetical. And I say, imagine a guy named Ed moves to another country, and he's completely free to speak, but he's not free to speak on public parks. He's not free to speak through the postal system, and he's not free to speak through the internet. Right? He can only speak through the property that he owns, you know, his own house with yard signs. And if we lived in an environment like that, we would think, that doesn't sound like freedom of speech. Right? When we think of freedom of speech, we think of people in public parks speaking, people on blogs and in chat rooms and in, quote, cyberspace. We think of people in Zuccotti Park during Occupy Wall Street or in Tahrir Square in Egypt, in Cairo. And the question I ask is, right, First Amendment scholarship tends not to focus on the question of access to spaces for average people to speak. And it tends to, when it does discuss those issues, it always does so in sort of siloed ways. It looks at one kind of property, a public park, it looks at another property, cyberspace, and it doesn't actually draw underlying themes from all of them. And that's what I try to do in this paper, to see if there are unifying principles across spaces that are owned by the government and those that are owned by the private sector that can be regulated for access, such as, you know, cyberspaces that are on private lines. And I also look at not only private and publicly owned spaces, but physical spaces and virtual spaces. And so I just try to draw underlying principles that tend to define what we historically have believed necessary for Americans to speak. You know, certain kinds of access to spaces is necessary, and sort of plentiful access. So if I were to say it in one sentence, it's the principle that in order to have real free speech in our society, we need to ensure that individuals have access to the spaces where people speak in our society, which include both the internet and parks and streets and any place where people speak democratically.
This topic is obviously a massive one, And even in an article which, with footnotes, runs to 83 pages, you're still, while you're going in depth, at the tip of the iceberg. Nonetheless, you go through a number of theories underlying the First Amendment, which we'll talk about some in a moment. But I'm curious. You mentioned Yochai Benkler as someone from whom you took classes as a student. If you were to identify, and I'm sure there are many, but if you were to identify a few in particular, who would be the most influential scholars on the First Amendment that have animated this article?
So certainly Yochai Benkler. He was not only my communications law professor and my third-year advisor in law school. I took a fellowship with him at Yale afterward, and he has, his work and guidance have been, central to my scholarship ever since. Other people, Larry Lessig is an important influence for anyone who thinks about, freedom and the internet. Tim Wu's work, but in terms of the First Amendment specifically, mm-hmm. I'd say C. Edwin Baker. C. Edwin Baker, who tragically died a few years ago, is, I think, perhaps the great First Amendment scholar of the second half of the 20th century, I'd say. And Owen Fiss at Yale, Jerry Barron at GW. I'm sure I'll forget people, but I would say Ed Baker and Yochai Benkler, Jack Balkin at Yale, tend to be the people who are most influential in my thinking. And I think most right about what the First Amendment means and should mean.
And that's where we're going in a moment. I guess I'll ask one further question to that point. For those listening to the show who are not First Amendment scholars, and maybe this is a tough question, but I'll ask it anyway. Is there a book or a work that you would recommend to them that is accessible, but also obviously gets into the topic that would be a good place to, other than your article, of course, to read about the First Amendment more broadly?
So that's a great question. I think that I would recommend a white paper by Yochai Benkler written in about 2001, which has an awful title, Towards a Core Common Infrastructure, I think. But if you just Google white paper, Yochai Benkler for the Brennan Institute, that paper is pretty helpful, I think. But also the book that I would read, which isn't directly on the First Amendment, it's sort of framed in terms of innovation, that covers a lot of the issues in the internet space, Larry Lessig's The Future of Ideas. And it's focused in terms of innovation, not the First Amendment. There's some First Amendment discussion in there. And those are two basic works I tend to recommend, Yochai Benkler's white paper and Larry Lessig's Future of Ideas.
Yeah, I can vividly remember purchasing The Future of Ideas when I was in practice in New York, and I'd say about 10 years ago now, maybe a little longer when it came out, and reading that book and having several epiphanies with regard to the work that I was doing in copyright and trademark litigation. So that I certainly concur with both of the recommendations, in fact. Let's turn... again, from a top level, before we get into some of the details of your article, Marvin, and ask you this question with regard. And again, I'm tailoring these questions as much as possible, recognizing that this is a huge topic. You talk about democracy and autonomy as the two core First Amendment values that animate the analysis that you do in your article, First Amendment Architecture, in Wisconsin Law Review. Again, recognizing that those are huge words, what do you mean by democracy and autonomy in the context of the First Amendment?
That's a great question. So let me give a very brief answer and then try to give a concrete example of what inspired me to write this paper and to focus on first principles like democracy and autonomy. So what a common way of analyzing legal outcomes, right? Like if you're a law professor, what you do is you look at a decision made by the Supreme Court, and law professors always say this decision was rightly decided or it was wrongly decided. And what they kind of mean is I agree with this decision or I don't agree with this decision. what they also mean is there are some principles by which I will judge this decision or this law, whatever they're judging. There are some principles that I will apply. And when you apply these principles, here's what the outcome should be. Here's what the law should do. And so if you're analyzing contract law cases or property law cases, as many people do in first year law school, the principle that you apply, that people often apply, might be efficiency, economic efficiency. And then you define what you mean by economic efficiency. Right? So you'll say, I mean Kaldor-Hicks efficiency, which is a kind of efficiency, or Pareto optimal efficiency, another kind of economic efficiency. And you have all these different assumptions. And then you say, once I decide this principle, the principle of efficiency, the exact definition of which I've just defined, I'm going to take this principle and I'm going to apply it to this property law case. And I'm going to say, okay, this outcome is right or this outcome is wrong based on whether or not it furthers the goal of efficiency. And people debate about what the right goal should be. Should it just be efficiency? Should it be distribution and equality of economic, property? What should the principle be? And then they'll argue about whether or not you've applied the principle accurately in measuring a property law case or a contract law case. On the First Amendment side, people do something similar. What they do is they look at a case or a law and they say, how do we measure this? And then one way of measuring it is, does it agree or disagree with precedent? Precedent is sometimes easy to it doesn't always point in the right direction. So you might then go to the underlying principle, which for the First Amendment isn't economic efficiency. It tends to be democracy, promoting democracy, or promoting individual liberty. Those are the two main principles that First Amendment scholars tend to point to when they're judging whether or not a case is correctly decided or not. So what you have to do to apply these principles, you have to define, what do I mean by democracy? What do I mean by autonomy? We'll begin with democracy, right? To figure out what kind of principle you're going to use for democracy, it almost ends up determining the result. But some people think democracy should be, there are a range of definitions of democracy. And you can read the democratic theorists, you can dive through centuries of political philosophy. But as a general rule, some democratic theories argue that a society is democratic merely with the right to vote and no discrimination under law. Some theories require sort of more robust means of democracy, like public education. We need to make sure everyone has the education to take part in our democracy. Free speech. There should be free speech to communicate. Sort of like basic indicia of democracy. And so, what I mean by democracy, I tend to argue in the article that there's a wide range of different ways to think of democracy, and any of the more robust democratic, any of the democratic principles that require, sort of more out of democracy than just you vote every 4 years, and that's a democracy. You have a choice between two people every 4 years. We'll call that a democracy. Anything that's really more, that requires more than that, that's the principle that I use. And then I say, if we wanted a democracy that was actually vibrant, what kind of speech architecture would we need? And on the individual liberty side, same thing. There's a whole range of different definitions for what individual liberty and autonomy is. Some people argue you can't have liberty without, money. Some people think you're still free even if you can't get, free gold. So there's a range of arguments when you look at the philosophical literature, and you have to define what principle you're going to use to judge cases. And I sort of argue that under a whole range of different theories of autonomy, we would need to structure our speech environment sort of like the internet, right? Decentralize giving everyone access to be able to speak with one another, sort of like the internet is now, versus the way broadcast TV was, with just a few people having a huge sound and impact on our speech environment without our ability to speak back or to comment and to share, things like that.
We're chatting with Marvin Amori, author of the article First Amendment Architecture, out in the Wisconsin Law Review, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that it is on KZSU-FM, which is a non-commercial, non-profit radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our website at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to listen to the show. Marvin, let's turn in more detail.
Can I modify the answer to a question you asked earlier?
Oh, of course, please.
So you asked earlier how my advocacy affects my scholarship.
Sure.
And so let me just give you an example of a moment I had while an advocate.
Okay.
So I was the head lawyer of a group called Free Press, and in that role, I wrote a complaint against Comcast when Comcast was interfering with BitTorrent and other peer-to-peer technologies. This was about 2007. And then this complaint led to an FCC hearing, and then it led to an FCC decision where the FCC ordered Comcast to stop interfering with BitTorrent and other peer-to-peer technologies, and it affirmed a sort of a net neutrality principle in the Comcast-BitTorrent decision at the FCC. That decision was appealed by Comcast to the D.C. Circuit, which is an appellate court in Washington, D.C. And Comcast appealed that case, making arguments around administrative law and around the statute, right? So around what the Communications Act said and around what the Administrative Procedures Act said. Comcast didn't make an argument about the First Amendment, which is a constitutional limit that would have applied to any decision made by the FCC. Even though Comcast didn't raise a First Amendment argument, one of the judges looked at the Comcast lawyer during the argument and said, "Wait a minute, you're a cable company. Why aren't you making a First Amendment argument? Why aren't you saying that the FCC can't regulate your speech as a cable company?"
Mm-hmm.
So let's unpack this, right? What Comcast was doing was blocking the ability, or at least degrading and interfering with the ability, of people to share things through BitTorrent, legal or illegal, through BitTorrent. Like lots of legal content gets distributed through peer-to-peer technology. One example being Miro, which is an open-source video application created by the nonprofit, the Participatory Culture Foundation, up in Massachusetts. Right? So completely legal content. It's a nonprofit organization, just a pro-free speech organization. Their content is getting interfered with by Comcast. And the judge says to Comcast, "Don't you have a free speech right to edit the internet, essentially, and to block the content you don't like on the internet? And can't the government, can't you simply assert a right against the government ever telling you what to do in terms of the speech on the internet?" So this fits in with, what was going on is the judge was assuming that the speech that we care about is the speech of the cable company and the broadband provider, not the speech of Miro or any other speaker who uses the internet and thinks of the internet as a space for them to speak, right? Is the internet a space for all of us to communicate, or should we think of it as simply the cable company's speech and the government can't interfere with the cable company? And the model that the judge had in his mind was the model of the flag burner, right? Comcast is like a flag burner, or like somebody handing out pamphlets, and it doesn't want to hand out some pamphlets, let's call them BitTorrent packets, and it wants to drop them. And here the government is forcing Comcast to hand out pamphlets or to stop burning a flag or whatever. It's just an image of Comcast as the speaker, not an image of We have a certain environment that people speak within. We have certain contexts and customs, and people think of and have used the internet as a space to speak, and have used parks as a space to speak, have used the internet for democratic participation in a way that, you know, has affected, you know, the trajectory of the Middle East and has affected our own elections every 4 years or every 2 years. Right? We can think of the First Amendment as simply a defense for cable companies against regulation, or as an aspirational guide for how we structure our speech in our society as new technologies emerge. And so it's really that's an example of where I think scholarship has gone wrong and why I thought this article was important. And so if you're listening to this radio show, just think to yourself, do I really think that the First Amendment should mean cable and phone companies can edit any speech being transmitted through text messages or the internet or any other way, as though they're, you know, speakers handing out pamphlets? Or do I think of them as spaces open to speech, and that government and society has a role in ensuring those avenues of speech are open and as open as, you know, the public parks are?
Well, that gets to, and I appreciate that point there, Marvin, because it gets to a phrase that you use in the article repeatedly that I think is helpful in understanding the critique that you offer in this article, which is this idea of a negative liberty model, which sounds a bit abstract, but I think you've tied it in. But let's be clear, what does that mean?
So I love how we're talking political theory so much on the radio.
Yeah, that's what Hearsay Culture does well.
love it. Yeah. So political philosophers often distinguish between negative liberty and positive liberty. And both of these concepts have been critiqued, but we'll leave that aside for now. Negative liberty is the idea that you have a freedom, a liberty from government, right? You're free from government. Government should stay out of your private affairs, stay out of your business. You just want to be left alone. That's the kind of liberty you care about as a negative liberty. Then, on the other side, some people advocate for a, quote, positive liberty, which is essentially a liberty to a particular outcome, whether or not the government has to be involved to ensure that outcome. So you have a liberty to eat. You have a liberty to an education. These are sort of positive liberties. And even positive liberty to shape your own destiny through voting, right? So, right, we can't really have positive liberty without negative liberty, but some people emphasize negative liberty. If you're like a libertarian, or if you really, you know, just want sort of government out of your hair, you emphasize a negative liberty. And what I argue is that the First Amendment scholarship of today assumes that the First Amendment is a negative liberty. It's like a very strict negative liberty. You're supposed to keep government out of speech. You know, government can't influence the person who's protesting at funerals. Government shouldn't interfere with the flag burner or the person who's yelling hate speech on street corners. Right? Government should stay out and let the, quote, free market of speech play its course. On the other side, in order to believe that, in order to be a First Amendment scholar and believe that existing law reflects a negative liberty, you have to ignore most of existing law. So if you look at the Communications Act, you know, it's several hundred pages of government being involved in speech. If you look at, you know, if you look at the phone industry, the cable industry, the broadcast industry, the satellite industry, the internet, the postal service, and the many complex speech-based policies that were designed to promote newspapers being distributed on the frontier in the founding era. If you look at all of these rules and regulations throughout our history, you see that government has been actively and deeply involved in what we think of as private speech, in terms of structuring the environment to make speech available. And the example I often use is the Postal Service, because it comes from the founding era and it includes and it, it uh, it's focused on newspapers, but the Postal Service was primarily designed to carry newspapers. I mean, its primary purpose was to carry newspapers to remote hamlets and towns. And the U.S. government invested heavily in building out postal roads, trying to connect the public, subsidizing the carriage of newspapers and taxing the carriage of all other mailing material to try to foster a national society where the public would be informed of what was going on and could participate in our democracy. And even though the Postal Service was owned by the government has imposed similar rules on private companies such as broadcasting, like the way they allocated TV broadcast stations was designed to promote local stations in every community based on certain core principles about how our speech environment should be structured. And these are the several principles that I mentioned in the paper. Mm-hmm. So at any rate, that's my answer.
And with regard to those issues, and we're at the unfair portion of the show, unfair because I ask questions that may not be answerable in the 11 or so minutes that we have left. Let me turn to something which is of, I think, particular interest. You note in the article is perhaps a surprising result. You argue, or at least that's how I read the article, but you tell me if I'm right. You appear to take an anti-cyberspace exceptionalism position with regard to First Amendment. And again, for those that don't focus on internet law theory, there's you know, a continual debate about whether the internet is sufficiently different such that we need new laws, or whether current law written, or increasingly not written outside the world of technology, but certainly written, most of it written prior to the advent of the commercial internet, is good enough. And I think somewhat surprisingly, although you point out some people will be pleased by this, you appear to take the position that we don't really need new law for the internet. But perhaps you could talk about that in a few minutes, and whether I'm reading your article correctly.
So I think that's right. I don't think we need new First Amendment doctrine for the internet. But just to clarify, people will debate what the existing doctrine means for the internet. Like the example I gave from the judge at the Comcast case, right, in his mind, the existing law that applies to the First Amendment and the internet means that, you know, gosh darn it, Comcast can't be regulated because it affects their speech rights. The argument I make is that, no, the internet, right, a net neutrality rule for the internet would be more like a designated public forum doctrine, which is where a government can designate spaces to be available to speakers. It can do that on public property. It can also do that on private property, as it's designated shopping malls to be open for speech. And it's designated, you know, cable systems, et cetera. So people will debate what the existing doctrine means. And I do think that that'll probably be more persuasive to judges rather than saying we need a whole new legal structure to argue, actually, we have these core principles, throughout our First Amendment jurisprudence that guide us in one direction or another. The other side were arguing for exceptionalism because that would be easier for me to defeat them. But they tend to argue from, you know, from flag-burning cases and from what they consider to be core cases. So the limiting principles, by the way, the core principles that I argue for across all these media. Mm-hmm. You know, what I argue is and here's why I what brought me to these principles. I knew that if I argued for...
And Marvin, I'll ask you to talk about this in about 3 minutes.
Oh, okay, sure. Yeah. I'll speak quicker. Yeah. So I knew that if I argued for a positive liberty by the government, that instead of a negative liberty, people would think that there's no, you know, government would come in and start silencing speech and silencing us all. And so there need to be some sort of principle. People would often argue for a principle that, well, broadcasting is different, cable is different. But then every time you argued something was different, a new medium would come along, like the internet or mobile or whatever it would be, and people would say, no, this is the one, this medium should be treated like the others, and Comcast or Verizon should be treated like a flag burner and protected from any regulation at all. So I needed a sort of principle that constrained government yet could be extended to new media. And so just looking through the precedent, I was surprised to see several principles that cut across so many different areas, not just electronic media, but physical spaces. So the principles are essentially that, I'll just give them to you quickly, hopefully in a minute, that government must leave some spaces open to speakers. Parks must be open. The courts require parks to be open to speakers, whether in private cities or, you know, government-owned cities. And then on top of that, most of the other principles are discretionary. The government can open up additional spaces, whether they're virtual cyberspace or they can open up physical spaces owned by the public, owned by private individuals. And in opening these spaces, government can promote diverse and antagonistic sources. The idea being that, diverse speakers will provide different points of view on a topic and inform us better as for our democracy. Government can extend speech spaces to all Americans, that everyone has access to the internet or broadcasting or cable or satellite or the newspapers through the postal system. Right, this is a core principle that everyone should be connected and everyone should have access to numerous diverse sources. And that's really what the National Broadband Plan, for example, is about, extending broadband, open internet to all Americans. That government can promote local spaces and national, and spaces for national discourse. And so I think those principles aren't dangerous. I think they all point towards greater democracy and individual liberty. And I think they're all defensible. And that's really the core of the end of the paper, is to defend those principles and hopefully to change people's thinking about what the First Amendment means and orient it more for the 21st century.
And we're talking with Marvin Amori, author of the article First Amendment Architecture, having been published in a Wisconsin Law Review. Marvin, in the remaining about 5 minutes, 4 or 5 minutes that we have, let me ask you a few of those forward-looking articles. Now, I'm not asking you to pull out a crystal ball, so I won't turn you into a futurist. On the other hand, I do want to get your sense of things. And I'll ask you this question. As I mentioned in the introduction, your article's been discussed a bit, concurring opinions, on which I will be guest blogging in September, did a online symposium on the article, bringing on a number of both future and former guests on Hearsay Culture, Daniel Citron and Brett Frischman, who both been on the show before, and others who I anticipate having on down the road, discuss the article. But I'm curious to get your sense of this. Having written a law review article that has gotten unusual attention in terms of discussion outside of the field, as it were. What's your sense of its impact so far, and what's your hope for its impact going forward?
You know, that's a good question. I'm glad it got unusual attention, because I tried my best to promote it any way I could. Probably the best attention it received was one of the Stanford journals devoted a third of their annual symposium to it, and then Yochai Benkler defended it, and Lillian Bevere of UVA, a well-known First Amendment scholar, critiqued it. And judging from that debate, I'm hoping that the people who I would say agree with me in outcomes and what the First Amendment should mean, I hope it really helps them to articulate a sort of stronger, I want to say almost like a replacement or a better model for what the First Amendment means than the one that completely ignores the most important mediums of our day, right? That people just focus on the First Amendment from the point of view of the internet and electronic media and how people actually speak to one another in society, and stop focusing on pamphlets and hate speech, which is not where people get their information and their culture and how they express themselves usually. So one is to focus on a different factual context of focusing on the internet. And two, that you know, it sort of provides an intellectual framework to defend, from a First Amendment perspective, a lot of the rules that people think empower citizens to speak. And so, you know, to the extent that, you know, if you slave away and get a net neutrality rule through this, you know, corrupt FCC, if you want to call them corrupt, and this unknowledgeable Congress, you know, we shouldn't have to go up before a court and then face, you know, highly strict scrutiny from the First Amendment simply for empowering more citizens and, quote, burdening the speech rights of the largest cable companies and the largest studios and other powerful players. So that's what I'm hoping. I don't think I persuaded Lillian Bevere, although she hadn't really thought about common carriage or other rules like that adopted by Congress for the phone system and for the internet as free speech issues. And if you I think that if we can get, and she had a very stringent critique of my paper, but if we can get them thinking about these as First Amendment challenges, they have to at least modify or defend their own views. And so I hope it does have an effect across the board, not only with those who instinctively agree with me, but those who instinctively do not.
Marvin, in the last 60 seconds, being that you work on a variety of topics, quickly, what are you currently focusing on? What can we look forward to in the next year or two? Perhaps, what are you going to be doing in your fellowship?
So I am right now. I'm thinking a little bit about how we can promote free speech and economic innovation and how they're connected to each other around the world. But for the fellowship, what I'm thinking about and what I will be working on is a book on First Amendment issues and the internet, and, you know, hopefully a book that can boil down these concepts in a way that anyone can understand them, with the, you know, the model being Larry Lessig's Future of Ideas, if I could write such a clear and important book.
And that certainly is, I think all of our goals in academia to have to write something of that influence. Although I think this article is a great step in that direction. Marvin Amori, author of the article First Amendment Architecture, Wisconsin Law Review. Thank you for joining us in Hearsay Culture. Obviously we are colleagues through CIS, but more importantly, I appreciate the contributions you're making. I look forward to having you back on the show, and I thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, David. It's been a pleasure.
Let me mention a couple of guests coming up for the summer quarter of Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that the show goes on hiatus during KZSU's interim period, which begins in mid-June. This show is being recorded on May 30th for airing in early June, and that will be, in fact, the last show of this quarter. And I'm actually, at this point, looking at a rather shallow list at this point of future guests. Currently, I have booked a professor, I got to be careful, to be clear, they're great guests. I just don't have as many booked as I normally do at this time, so let me be clear about that. Professor Brett Frischman of Cardozo Law, author of the book Infrastructure, The Social Value of Shared Resources, will be back on the show, as well as Andrew Renz, Research Associate at the Center for the Study of Public Domain, Baron Zoka of Tech Freedom, co-editor of The Next Digital Decade, and Professor Julie Cohen of Georgetown Law will be returning, author of the book Configuring the Network Self. I have saved the remaining slots, and there are a good five or six for the summer, because I want to take a closer look at what's out there. And I intend to be sending out invitations for those remaining slots over the next couple of weeks, so that the schedule is set by about mid-June. So now would be a great time for you to email me with any suggestions you have for people that should be on the show. And I do, to be clear, read those suggestions, and while I can't guarantee I will follow them, I certainly will consider them seriously, and often do follow them. You can email me at dave@hearsayculture.com with any of those suggestions. As always, you can listen to the show on KZSU this quarter, Tuesdays at 3 p.m. That may change in the next quarter, which begins in July. But in the interim, you can also listen to all current and previous shows via podcast on either the Center for Internet Society's iTunes page or by going to the website for CIS at cyberlaw.stanford.edu or by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can also get the upcoming schedule. I thank, of course, as I do every at the end of every quarter, I thank not only the program director and the chief engineer, but the other engineers and Rasmus, who was working the board this quarter for his work, and the support of KZSU generally for this show, which to my amazement is entering its sixth year on the air. I started the show in May of 2006. It's now past May, or I'm in May of 2012. Entering its seventh year, to be even more clear. Thank you for the support of everyone over the last 6 years, and I hope that you found the show as valuable and as fun to listen to as I find it to record. With that, thank you for listening. Enjoy the next few weeks without the show, and I look forward to chatting with you in July. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.